Skillen was a histopathologist, University in one of the Chicago schools. 200 pulpous x-ray negative teeth were examined histologically, and only six showed evidence of infection. The next slide. What I'm trying to show you are more or less laboratory tests, laboratory studies. Again, I have a little something to do with this study. Blood counts were taken, including the RNF count. The RNF count, somewhat similar to a Schilling count, something like this. If there was a shift to the left, that is, there were more if there are one or two lobes, polymorphonuclear cells, in excess of one third of the total polymorphonuclear cell population, then it meant that there was a shift to the left. Ordinarily, according to the RNF count, this would mean the presence of infection. So, using the RNF count, they found that after taking a preoperative and a postoperative, and also 1 month later a postoperative blood count, they found that there was greater improvement following root canal treatment on the left than extraction. I personally felt that there is no significant change, but since I was not an author of the paper, I couldn't say anything. The next slide. Then, according to various blood counts taken by all of these different people, there didn't seem to be any material difference in most cases when comparing the blood count after the removal of oral infection as compared with the pre-operative count. The next slide. Benzie and Clark Kennedy are two English gastroenterologists. The teeth of 76 patients were removed for a possible cause of dyspepsia, what we would call gastritis or gastroenteritis. Only six of these benefit. Now, the same authors did another study. The next slide. In which 126 patients for whom teeth were removed for dental reasons, 39 or 31% later developed symptoms of dyspepsia, and 19 or 15% developed rheumatic symptoms. So apparently there was no relationship between the teeth and the dyspepsia. And from now on, you'll find the numbers in each of these studies will increase. The next slide. Cecil, at one time, was our most famous rheumatologist in this country. 52 patients had teeth extracted, 47 were not benefited, temporary benefit to two, and three became worse following the extraction of teeth, which were thought to cause arthritis. Next slide. Bauer, here at Massachusetts General Hospital, examined 300 arthritics. Those in whom teeth had been removed showed less improvement than those whose teeth had not been removed. His study was followed up by another person at Mass General, namely Dr. Short, and confirmed Bauer's original study. The next slide. Woods at Johns Hopkins examined 500 patients with cataract, which is not due to infection, and found that they had a pulpous teeth or oral foci infection just as often as in 500 patients with uveitis, which is due to infection. Now, studies of this kind really did have an impact on the medical profession. The unfortunate thing was that it did not reach the dental profession. The next slide. Arnett and Ennis. Ennis is the author of a textbook on radiology. Arnett, a physician. Of 883 students examined at Drexel University, 20% had chronic verifying osteitis, but it was not associated with chorea, rheumatism, or heart disease, which were diseases thought to be resulting from oral foci of infection. The next. Stein at, in South Africa evaluated the elimination of foci of infection in more than 1,000 patients. Condition was unaltered in 81%, became worse in 6%, and condition was improved in 13%. The next slide. Ziskin, formerly, he's dead now, unfortunately, formerly at Columbia University, examined radiographs. He was head of the oral diagnosis. Examined radiographs of 1,500 patients. Of that number, 48% were sick, 52% were well. He then reversed the procedure. Of those that were sick, 71% had pulpous teeth, and of those that were well, 75% had pulpous teeth. No difference again. Again, from the standpoint of pulpous teeth, 46% were sick, 54% were well, confirming the above, and of those without pulpous teeth, 50% were sick and 50% were well. So, whichever way the examination went, there was no difference whether a person had pulpous teeth or not. The next slide. Coleman, again, an internist, examined over 2,000 persons medically, and there was no apparent relationship between periapical rarefaction when present and systemic disturbances. The next slide. Cunningham examined more than 12,000 college women as to whether they had normal tonsils, diseased tonsils, or had their tonsils removed. Quote, the group with normal tonsils and the group with pathologic tonsils differ by small percentages, which are statistically insignificant in the incidence of scarlet fever, diphtheria, pneumonia, chronic cold, rheumatism, chorea, mastoiditis, cervical gland infection. The group with absent tonsils gave a history of a higher incidence of all illnesses and operations than to those with normal tonsils or the group with pathologic tonsils, end quote. And I'll have something more to say about tonsils in a moment. The next slide. Frankel at the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company had an examination or evaluation of more than 16,000 people who gave a history of gastritis, gastric disturbances, hypertension, heart murmurs, heart rate, vertigo, and on the basis of urinalysis findings, found that there was no difference whether they had pulpous teeth or not, no difference whether they had cranial bridge work, and no cranial bridge work. The next. In an evaluation of 2.5 million men of draft age, I think this is the First World War, a gastric ulcer, endocarditis, arthritis, myositis, muscular rheumatism, There is no relationship between oral side effects and anti-particular. Next slide. Now let's look over the fence, the medical profession. Served by several hundred gynecologic operations with removal of 704 normal ovaries is reported. The purpose of the paper is to call attention to the unwarranted sacrifice of normal ovaries. Next slide. To the editor, in what percentage of the cases of uterine displacement is surgery performed? Answer, the exact percentage of cases in which surgery is done for uterine displacements is not known, but in the opinion of most gynecologists, it is too high. The next slide. What I'm trying to show is that other organs considered expendable in the body, other body organs considered expendable, were also removed. The removal of great numbers of teeth, this from an editorial, or operations on the nose and throat on the chance of a possible relationship between infection and chronic arthritis is no longer considered a scientific procedure. The next slide. Summary, the operation of tonsillectomy as ordinary, this is from the Journal of the AMA, performed is considered to be a failure as evidenced by 68% of tonsillectomies in a group of 1,000 tonsillectomized patients. Careful dissection, which is facilitated by described technical methods, especially the position of the patient, has been successful in 99% of 262 patients. I happen to be a person who had his tonsils out three times, no less. The next slide. The Spooths, another paper, recently reported the fact that the tonsil stumps in 80% of 285 tonsillectomized patients. The next slide. And this will be my last slide, and it's a corker. Backman and Backman are husband and wife pediatricians. They were funded by NIH. They examined 1,000 children, they took 1,000 children to physicians. They were told that 610 had bad tonsils and should have their tonsils removed. That left 390 with normal tonsils. Well, then they took these 390 to other physicians, and were told that 175 should have their tonsils removed. So they took these, what was left, should be correct.
Yeah.
Of 215 children whom they took to others, 98 were told that they had bad tonsils and left 117. So they took those 117, were told that 53 needed to have their tonsils removed, and that left 64, and no further consultations were done. Now look down this column, percentage column. It's a toss-up on whether a physician will say that the child has bad tonsils and should have them removed or not. You can make that decision yourself. Of course, today, tonsillectomies are not done quite as often as they used to. And it is a good thing, because apparently the tonsils do serve some function. And they're part of the reticular endothelial system. And nose and throat men today are not quite as quick in using the snare to snare both the patient and the tonsils. I say to snare the nation because I remember we took Aaron's daughter to a Nogico man to inquire about what we thought about in consoles, because she had an allergy, and matter of fact still does. And he said she should have her consoles out. And before we knew it, he already called up the hospital, already made arrangements. She was to go there the next day, never asking us whether he wanted to have the consoles removed. Well, he didn't take her to the hospital. He simply took her to another nosocomial man. He examined her and he said, there's no reason why, that I can see. We didn't tell him that we'd been through this first person. I can see no reason why she should have her consoles out. Sure it would be normal, etc. But there was a time when consoles, teeth, prostate, appendix were removed just indiscriminately. Happily, we're past that day. Now the question arises, should all pulpous teeth be left in situ, even if we see an error of artifact? No, of course not. We do have a focus of infection. But that does not mean that a focal infection is present or could develop. We see from time to time at our school patients who perhaps have had foci of infection. School patients who had foci of infection of the jawbones for 20 years, who are nevertheless in good health. We do feel, however, that if a focus of infection is present, it should be removed, because it is contributing to the body defenses having to be more active. There is a balance between the infection which is present and the body defenses, and the body defenses are ordinarily able to bring about a stalemate. But sometime in the future, the body defenses may be weakened, and the result may be a flare-up, a local flare-up, with systemic response. Fever, malaise, constipation, the usual symptoms of an acute, full-blown acute abscess. Also, we feel strongly that when a periapical focus of infection is present, it should be treated rather than have the tooth extracted, unless it can't be treated, if the person has a valvular heart defect, or gives a history of having had a valvular defect, because it has been shown that subacute bacterial endocarditis does occur in anywhere from 5 to 10% of cases where a tooth is extracted. There's history of a tooth having been extracted in such cases, so that we do not close our eyes to the fact that a focus of infection is present, but we feel that focal infection does not ordinarily occur from a periapical focus of infection. So that from the standpoint of bodily health, the removal by treatment, if at all possible, or else by extraction, is indicated wherever a focus of infection is present, whether it be in the jawbone or in some other part of the body. And with that, I will close and thank you very much for this morning's session.
Dr. Grossman, what type of particular problems did you yourself run into amongst the profession and the medical profession when you were treating patients in the height of the focal infection area?
Two kinds, as I think I've already mentioned. One kind is a patient who wouldn't even consult a physician, but come to the dentist and say she has some systemic disorder, whatever it be, and she would like to have any infected teeth out. Remember, I was in general practice at first. And so this was one type. The second type was much more difficult to handle. And that is the physician telling a patient that that patient had a focus of infection in the mouth, but he was sure that it was due to an infected tooth or infected teeth. And you took x-ray films and you pulp tested all the teeth revealed, absolutely no evidence of a rarefaction or even of a thickened periodontal ligament space. And so what do you do in a case like that? You call up the physician and you told him that there is no evidence of infection in that patient's mouth. Sometimes it would be a young person in late teens. And you had sort of a battle on your hands when the physician says, I'm sure there must be. And the other kind of case was where there was a pulpous tooth present, and it was absolutely x-ray negative. And you tested it for percussion, and you learned that it was asymptomatic, etc. And it had a good lamina dura even. And you told the physician that, and he would still insist, especially if he was an ophthalmologist. And you were stuck. And some of those patients didn't have their teeth out. They went to another dentist for another opinion. And perhaps that other dentist was what we call a 100%er. A 100%er is a person who felt that all pulpous teeth should be removed. Then there was another type of case where an area of rarefaction was present, and you had to do, this was an untreated tooth, and you had to do root canal treatment, and the patient wanted the tooth out, and the physician wanted the tooth out. And you had to bow before them, or else, if it was an anterior tooth, I solved it in this manner. I told the physician that before this root canal was filled, we would take two cultures, one acting as a check on the second one acting as a check on the first. We would not fill the root canal unless both cultures were negative. And that's part of the physician. But there were some who wouldn't be part of even then. And I would say, Doctor, I'm sure you've seen abdominal surgery done. For example, because of acute appendicitis being present. Did you notice that the surgeon took a culture before he sewed up the patient? Well, that also helped. Then finally, there was another kind of case where the only way I could quiet the physician was to tell him that I would do a root resection, correct the bone, and that was also at times successful. And when they heard that You see, their idea was that there is infection present in the jawbone, and that infection was causing the trouble. They wouldn't, I can assure you, not 1,000,000% of them probably realized that the source of the infection was in the root canal. They had their mind focused on the jawbone itself. And so if you told them that the tip of the root would be cut off and the jawbone would be curetted, that satisfied them.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I'd like to know when Cutivertia cones first became popular.
Cutivertia cones? Oh, about 1860-something or other. The first person who suggested use of Cutivertia cones was someone in Hannibal, Missouri. Can't think of his name. Well, doesn't matter. But we've been using Cutivertia cones for over 100 years. And we are, at least I'm not altogether satisfied with them. I hope that someday there will be a better preparation than Cutivertia. But at the moment, it's, in my opinion at least, it's the best material for killing the canal. And I say so because in 1928, I brought back with me silver cones from Germany, and I had a hard time interesting a manufacturer of silver cones. Finally, I interested the Baker Company in New Jersey, no longer called the Baker Company, in manufacturing them, manufactured them just exactly as they were manufactured in Germany. Actually, those that I had were manufactured, but the original ones came from Vienna. At any rate, these were sharp-pointed cones, just like the German cones, and they didn't want to take a chance on any other shape. And then my friend Elmer Jasper in St. Louis, now deceased, unfortunately, he got a company in Missouri to manufacture, St. Louis actually, to manufacture silver cones, more or less corresponding to root canal instruments. That is the old numbered instruments from 1 to 12, which we used in those days, which was an improvement. But I confess that for a number of years now, I have not used silver cones. And the reason is that I've seen too many cases where I have not been able to remove a silver cone where retreatment had been done. And another case, of course, the silver cones almost fall out of the root canal. But I feel that as between Cutivertia and silver cones, the Cutivertia cone is superior in many respects, and particularly with the vertical condensation that we get a better condensed cone to fit the root canal.
Well, let me ask a quick question. Do you have any idea what ever happened to Dr. Hunter as an
actor? Dr. Hunter? Yeah. Well, he went back to England.
I'd like to recommend to the students that when you read Dr. Grossman's writings, you must really read them in sequence. And his contributions to the combating of the theory of focal infection in medicine, and especially in dentistry, is recorded best, I think, in the third and fourth editions of those, in the early chapters of the third and fourth editions of the book, which unfortunately later editions just can't have everything in dentistry, got too thick. But if you go back to the library and look at that, you'll find probably the most lucid explanation paralleling with what you heard today. Well, I'd like to just take a moment to tell you the good old days are not too far away. In 1973, in the city of Boston, and in the catalogs sent all over the world, the Pulptane Corporation of America was selling Nerve Arsine in 1973. And you remember, I believe, the Second World Conference of Endodontics, which you held, when the gentleman you invited from Johns Hopkins couldn't come and send someone else, I believe.
Right.
But he gave the wrong lecture, and he gave the lecture supporting the theory of functional affection, which appalled the audience, rather than giving the lecture the other way around. And I wrote to you at the time and said, you should send him a copy of your book to explain it. At the last meeting of the ADA, the American Dental Association, the very last meeting, a physician was given time to read a paper on the failure of hip transplants and hip prosthesis because of diseased teeth in his patients' mouths. And I was the American Dental Association this very last year. And unfortunately, a new term has been coined in Britain. 44% of the people who live in Scotland are edentulous, and 36% of the people in England are edentulous. The students know this. But what they don't know is that the Scotch became very defensive about this fact. And an English professor visited Scotland and gave a lecture in Glasgow in January, in which, in what was published in a 12-page report in the Journal of the British Dental Practitioner, he said there's no such thing as lifetime teeth. They don't exist. And you're being criticized unfairly. And if you went to America or to the continent, you would probably find teeth that are ravaged with the stains of time. And what we do here in England and in Scotland is perform a kind of dental euthanasia. That's a new term. But here we do dental euthanasia and do our patients a favor and remove the infected teeth. So we've come a long way. It seems that we still have a little way to go. Let's go downstairs, and if the food isn't out, it'll be set up, and let's just find a nice comfortable hour. Maybe even get some sun.